You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Hi, Blake. How are you?
I am absolutely fantastic. Hey, Matt, it's been a big week in news, hasn't it?
It has. What's the best thing you learnt this week?
Well, here's one of the best things that I did. I deleted the Facebook app off my phone.
Oh, that's a good first step.
Mm.
Good first step. Because there's no news on Facebook anymore, is there?
Well, I'm not sure there's anything good on Facebook. And I'm not sure anything good has been on there for a while, but anyway.
I'll tell you what, at the Doolanders podcast is pretty good.
Other than that, I should probably put it back on just for that. The other bit of news was that Biden and the US have rejoined the Paris Agreement. Yeah, how cool is that?
Very cool.
What is the Paris Agreement?
Is that the one where we all agree to eat more cheese and drink more red wine?
Yeah.
I think we're all on board with that for quite a while.
Geez, wouldn't it be good just to be sitting around one of those cafes, you know, out the front of, in one of those little seats, you know, those little red seats and little red tables in Paris.
It's going to be a while,
baguette,
mate.
Cheese. It's going to be a long time. Now, what is the Paris Agreement?
It is, of course, the agreement to limit global warming by well below 2 degrees when you compared to pre-industrial levels.
Of course it is.
It's nothing to do with cheese and wine.
No, I know. And the way that you seamlessly, like, you wouldn't even tell that you were reading those notes off your page. Anyway, I'll tell you who does know what the Paris Agreement is.
Yep.
And that is this week's guest.
Oh, Leslie.
Leslie Hughes. Now, Leslie, if anyone in Australia knows about climate change, Leslie knows. She's been studying, researching, analysing the cause and effect of climate change for the last well over 20 years. She describes herself as an explorer. Nick, let's hear from Leslie.
Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say, do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Hey, Leslie, thank you so much for joining us on the Doolanders. How are you?
I'm very well, and thank you for asking me.
Our pleasure. Hey, Nick, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Blake. How are you?
I'm better now than I was 45 minutes ago. So we are recording on the day that we're now released from Melbourne's 5-day snap lockdown. So that's handy. You are in Sydney, Leslie. No, you've had your little snap lockdown. How was that?
Well, I've been I feel rather guilty in that because I like working from home, I quite enjoyed the Sydney lockdown, and I don't live on the northern beaches, so I didn't have the last lockdown. So I've sort of got a bit of survivor guilt in a way that, you know, I feel that the COVID pandemic has touched me extremely lightly, and in fact there's been some quite good things come from it, but notwithstanding the global tragedy that it is.
Yeah. Hey, we'll delve into that in a little bit more detail. Really interested in what sort of impact COVID-19 has had on what you do. But if you could tell our listeners, what do you do?
Well, I'm an academic. I'm a professor of biology at Macquarie University, which is northwest of Sydney. I've been at Macquarie for a very long time. I have a biology background, but for some, well, a couple of decades now, I suppose. I've been working on the impacts of climate change on species and ecosystems, and more recently, I guess, have become what some would call an activist and I would call an advocate of climate action.
Yeah, cool. I'm glad you threw in that bit at the end there because from outsider looking in, that's what I, when we've done our research, that's what we see, right? We see you out there obviously with a ton of knowledge advocating for change. Hey, has COVID-19 been a help or a hindrance to your cause?
Well, in terms of raw reduction of emissions, it's been a help. Certainly any sort of economic slowdown with less manufacturing, less people getting on planes, less people driving, that all has an impact on the emissions generated by those activities. Of course, it's been a little bit balanced by people using more electricity, et cetera, at home. But overall, globally, we can see a bit of a reduction. It's probably about 7 or 8% reduction of global emissions that corresponds to the COVID pandemic. The real challenge, of course, is that, as I'll talk about later, I guess that's the level of reduction we actually need to see year in, year out in order to get to net zero and the prospect of a safer climate. But of course, what we're looking at now is as the vaccine starts getting rolled out and things start to pick up and people start to get back to their normal lives, we would expect those emissions to start climbing again, unfortunately.
And what about your ability to tell your story, like, you know, reach the masses?
I think telling the story in some ways has become a little bit easier. You know, over the last year, I've done lots and lots of webinars that normally I wouldn't have been able to fit that many talks in because it would have involved travel to a place, whereas just logging on for an hour online is very easy. So on the one hand, it's been easier. On the other hand, however, getting the message out about climate change has been more difficult because of the COVID-19 blanket media coverage. And this was really, really clear in Australia towards the beginning of last year, where we had our third major bleaching event on the Great Barrier Reef, which would have normally been front page news, but it was around about March, which was when, you know, there was sort of 110% media coverage of COVID for very understandable reasons. But anything else going on, like a major catastrophic bleaching event on the Great Barrier Reef, which was the third in 5 years, just flew right under the radar. So there's been pluses and minuses from the communication perspective.
Yeah, and of course, it felt like climate change had become front and centre right off the back of the terrible catastrophe we had with bushfires right across Australia. And then whilst it was front page news, you're right, COVID-19 came and it was gone.
That's right. So, you know, one catastrophe was replaced very, very quickly by another catastrophe. And, you know, that certainly had downsides, of course, for lots of things, but communicating about climate change was one of those casualties.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to come back to the work that you do today in a little while, but what we love to do on the Doolanders is find out, you know, more about who you are, where you came from, and how you arrived at doing what you do. So could you tell us, you know, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Sydney, up in the northwestern part of Sydney, you know, in a pretty, ordinary middle-class home, ordinary middle-class suburb. But I guess I had the great fortune of having my house backing onto bushland. And so from a very young age, I started in those days, you know, my parents didn't worry if I just disappeared off into the bush for a few hours. So probably wouldn't happen now. But I spent an enormous part of my childhood just wandering around the bush with my neighbour's dog and catching lizards and putting bugs in jars and bringing them home. And that sort of started me on my path, I guess, of becoming a biologist.
There was a time that you considered becoming a dairy farmer or even the glamorous life of a wildlife photographer. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. They were brief flirtations. The dairy farmer ambition, I grew up actually near a dairy farm at the Sanitarium Hospital in Northern Sydney. So, and I used to go and watch the cows getting milked. And for some reason, I thought that would be a good idea for a career. And then I found out that, of course, you have to get up at about 3 o'clock in the morning to be a dairy farmer. And as I'm not really a morning person, that put paid to that idea.
Yeah.
In terms of the wildlife photography, I did think that would be glamorous and interesting, and I was going to be, you know, on the front page of the National Geographic, etc. But I also got a bit practical about that because I figured that it would be a rather highly competitive business. So that didn't last very long either.
What did your mum and dad do? Did they influence your outlook on what you were going to do with your life?
My mum was an infant school teacher, so I guess, you know, I was exposed to teaching and the value of education from a young age. My dad was a chemist, a scientist originally.
Right.
Ended up working for the Department of Health. So, yeah, they both had tertiary qualifications at college, not university, but valued education. But, look, overall, looking back, they didn't pressure my sister and I at all in terms of what we did. They were generally supportive of our own decision making, for which I am grateful.
In some ways you've combined both teaching and science in what you do today, right?
Yes, indeed, though I wasn't very good at chemistry, and in fact I remember my father trying to help me with some chemistry assignments which turned into disasters. So I guess I have, and that's the wonderful thing about being an academic. I think it's a fantastic sort of yin and yang type job, with the yin being the teaching and the yang being the research, and the balance between those two is great, because I think teaching is a very giving activity,
yeah,
and research is actually quite a self-indulgent activity. And I think balancing those in a single job has been, for me, a great job.
Yeah, amazing. The only thing that I remember about chemistry is the Bunsen burner.
Yeah.
Geez, I love that.
And that was the fun part, really.
Burning stuff was the fun part. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like burning stuff and trying to make things sort of blow up was, you know, that was super cool.
Yeah.
So as you grew up and you got to your, you know, your teenage years, and you said you had this love of animals and the bush and nature, what did that lead to?
Well, I realised sort of towards the end of my schooling that if I wanted to follow the animal path, there was a couple of options. I could become a vet, but it wasn't really very attractive. I really just wanted to find out about animals, and I just loved watching them behave. Mm. So I decided I wanted to do zoology. I realised I could do that within a science degree. Sydney University was a relatively short train trip away, so
that was the basis of your uni choice.
It was absolutely a very practical basis. I think these days there's a lot more angst about choosing degrees and choosing universities, and all the universities have advising days and open days and that sort of thing, and the students turn up with their parents to ask questions. In my day, there wasn't any of that. You just ticked a box on a form, and for me it was purely ease of transport.
So what did zoology potentially offer for you then?
Well, look, I didn't know much really. I just thought, well, it's animals, so it's got to be good. I have to say I didn't really enjoy my first year of university very much, because I was forced to do things like maths and chemistry, which were not me really. It wasn't until I got into second year, when I could choose mostly biology-related subjects, that I then started to realise that I was doing the right thing, and I really, really loved it.
So where did that study progress to?
Well, I had did zoology, you know, a lot of zoology and ecology subjects. So, you know, I realized that really what I wanted to do was not study animals in a petri dish or a dissecting board, but actually study them out in the wild and understand their relationships with plants and the rest of the environment. So that's really what ecology is. So, you know, whereas I started thinking purely animal, I really sort of graduated and evolved into thinking about whole environments and the animals within them, especially the interactions between plants and animals. So I ended up majoring in ecology. I at some point during that process decided that actually being an academic would be quite a good job, and then realised that I would need some higher education, so an honours degree and then possibly a PhD later. But so I did honours. It was probably the worst year of my life, a very ill-conceived project, and I'm still glad that I survived.
And so are we. We were talking earlier and you said that there was a field trip to Pearl Beach when you were sorting mm-hmm. through a whole bunch of leaf litter that changed yep. the game for you. How?
Well, one of the great things about Sydney University, as it turned out, was they had a research station up at Pearl Beach, which is on the central coast of New South Wales, with a beautiful environment, surrounded by national park with a beautiful rock platform, etc. And so fairly early on in my second year zoology course, we spent 5 days up there with a group, which was also a fantastic social environment. You know, you really get to know your fellow students if you actually live with them in close quarters. But the project that we were doing was actually looking at the organisms that live in leaf litter, and that just meant we went out and picked up buckets of leaves and then sat with them on a tray and used a paintbrush to sort of sort them out and catch things with tweezers, etc. And I just realised that I absolutely loved doing this. You know, it was a really nerdy activity. You know, yeah. I can't imagine many people sharing this, but I would sit there, you know, after most people had gone off to smoke weed and get drunk, I suppose, and I would sit there with a paintbrush sorting leaf litter, you know, sort of maybe a bit of a goody two-shoes, I suppose. But I just thought, this is fantastic, you know, I just love doing this. And it really made me realise that I'd actually made a good choice with yeah. the degree and the direction. And so, you know, it was a sort of reinforcing of a choice that I had made without very much information. So I think yeah. I got lucky.
Yeah, nice one. You describe yourself in some ways as an explorer and mm-hmm. like having only met you a couple of days ago, I think it's a really apt description. Talk to us about your exploration in terms of travel through those younger years and perhaps, you know, other work as an example in an insurance company and what you learned from those travels and those experiences about, you know, what you were passionate about and what you wanted to do.
Well, I think I am an explorer. I love finding out new things. I think all scientists, if they're any good, are explorers by their nature, because science is about finding stuff out that nobody else knows about. So that is the essence of exploration. But more practically, I love travel. I love going to new places. I love experiencing things that I haven't experienced before, whether it's a new food or meeting new people or seeing a new site or just seeing a vista, that's what really thrills me. So after I finished honours, my then boyfriend, now husband, saved up. We thought, well, we didn't have any money. We wanted to travel. We wanted to do the usual year in Europe, backpacking around the place like a lot of young Australians would still like to do. So I got a job in an insurance company in an office in town, and that was, in some ways, I look back as a wasted year and in other ways a really formative year, because it told me what I didn't want to do with my life from that point on. So yeah. that was quite motivating later when I did return to study. But we saved up, and then off we went, and we chortled around Europe and Britain, the Middle East, and India and Nepal on the way home for about 11 months. And I still look back on that year as really one of the most fun years of my life.
Yeah.
A very self-indulgent thing to do, of course, but formative in its own way.
Super cool. So in the late 80s, as you describe it, you followed a bunch of ants around the bush for 4 years.
It sounds
crazy. Like, it almost sounds as bad as trying to sell insurance, but but you managed to get your PhD in behavioral ecology. So after you'd done that, your PhD suggested something, or the PhD supervisor suggested something to you. What was that?
Well, as you say, I'd done my PhD on seed dispersal by ants, which is an important ecological process in Australia, and I enjoyed it. But I was pretty over it by the end of the 4 years, and wrote a thesis, et cetera, and was sort of casting around for something to do next. And there was some opportunities to write an application for a government's postdoctoral fellowship, and I knew I didn't want to do it on ants, but I didn't really know what else. And my PhD supervisor at the time sort of said, well, you know, what about thinking about climate change and doing a big experiment, transplant experiment, about sort of looking at what might happen to the Australian environment in the future under a different climate? And I thought, oh, that sounds like I might get a job out of that, at least, you know, more likely than another 4 years following ants. So I started reading about climate change, and really that was it. You know, I wrote the application. I was lucky enough to get the scholarship. And I've subsequently talked about that in writing as being a bit of a Hotel California experience, because you might want to check out of climate change, but, you know, you can never leave, because over time it becomes such a core part of your being, because there's no other issue like it that... I guess I was hooked.
Can you describe to our listeners what the overarching, you know, thoughts were around climate change, which was probably called global warming in the late 80s more than climate change?
Yeah.
What was known about it? Was it fringe science at the time? What sort of level was it accepted?
Yeah. It was certainly accepted way back then by the majority of scientists. That hasn't changed. When I started reading the literature about climate change, I could basically cover all the literature. That's how few papers there were. you know, there might have been maybe less than 100 papers published a year, probably a lot less than that. These days there are tens of thousands of papers published a year, so no single scientist can actually keep on top of all of that literature. So climate change was certainly an issue that most educated people had heard of, but it was a very distant future prospect. You know, we were sort of vaguely worried, but it was all, the impacts were all going to be far into the future. And it was sort of more of academic and intellectual interest rather than real interest for everyday people. And of course, that's how much it's changed.
So as you moved your focus from biology into climate change, like, in those first few years, were there just revelations through your research and through your work that you thought, like, I'm staggered that I've found this out? And do you remember specifically what they were?
I don't think I can identify very many light bulb moments. Mm-hmm. I think it was more a growing realization, partly a bit of a growing dread over the next decade or so.
Right.
And gradually moving inexorably, I suppose, from climate change being a future, you know, interesting prospect to actually coming to the conclusion that the animals and plants that I loved studying were potentially in serious strife, and then coming to the conclusion inevitably that that meant the human race as well. But that took a long, kind of even a decade probably, to really get into my head. You know, along the way it was more, oh, this is interesting, I can publish a paper on that. And look, you know, these days a lot of academics are still motivated along those lines. You know, we get promoted on the basis of largely on what we publish and how often we publish and where we publish. So that is an inbuilt motivator for most research academics, rather than, shit, I really need to save the planet here.
So that shit, I really need to save the planet moment, that came to you, didn't it? Because you decided to really become a public commentator on what was actually happening. Did that have, how much of that had to do with you as a person and your, the way that you perceived or the way that your research was telling you what was going to happen? Was it the fact that you'd got married, you had a couple of kids, you were concerned about their future?
Mm-hmm.
What made you say, hey, I really need to do this? Academia and publishing papers, great, but I've got to speak out.
Yeah. Once again, it was a bit gradual, but I think I came to a crossroads when, I'd sort of worked my way up the ladder to professorial status over the years, as many people do. I became the head of my department for 3 years, and that sort of enabled me to sort of step outside and do some other things, and you get used to being able to influence things more broadly, and that I found an attractive and satisfying and enjoyable thing to do. So it was probably an evolution from that. And, of course, at the same time, public concern and scientific concern about climate change was growing. And it was really around the turn of the century, I suppose, when the impacts of climate change, you know, things were happening that were no longer future things. That, you know, it was clear that climate change was actually affecting both the weather and also the impacts of that changed weather. So those sort of things came together, and I guess it was when I stepped down as head of department that it really took off, because I faced the prospect of just sort of going back to being a regular academic, and I realised that that would not be particularly satisfying.
Mm.
But at the same time, because I'd gotten into the climate change area pretty early, I had been able, without really, deliberately doing it, but it was inevitable that when you get early into a new area that then subsequently takes off, people naturally think that you must be an expert, whether you feel like you're an expert or not. And there were, you know, there were conferences I went to early on in my climate change research journey where I was the only one there at an ecological conference talking about climate change. These days there'd be very few people that don't mention climate change in their talks. So I guess I was somewhat fortunate in landing in an area where there were very few people occupying that niche, which allowed me to kind of establish my own niche in that, which then when the governments and other bodies decided that they needed to pay more a bit attention to climate change, I and a few of my colleagues were there as sort of the experts, I suppose. So that led to opportunities. And I often think that I was lucky to get into climate change early, because the opportunities I've had in my career have been far greater than if I had just stayed as a regular academic in my little ivory tower publishing papers with my PhD students. So, you know, there was a combination of grasping opportunities, and I guess it comes back to that exploratory nature that I think I have, but also those opportunities naturally presenting themselves as community concerns started to grow, and those things came together. And one of the major things that was a turning point in my life of that coming together was after the election where Julia Gillard got in with a hung parliament, the crossbench And the Greens and Labor basically forced the issue on the clean energy future package. And as part of that package, they were going to bring in a carbon price. And in order to kind of, I guess, soften up the Australian public to be cynical, but also to inform the Australian public about climate change and its risks and opportunities, the Gillard government created a thing called the Climate Commission. And I was one of the people asked to go on that commission of six people. And that was a real turning point, I think, in my career.
How do you deal with what must be a fairly frustrating scenario where you find yourself a change of government creates opportunities for you and your cause, and then a change of government again will close those doors? You've got climate change is now quite broad, and you have documentaries such as The Inconvenient Truth, which came out at the turn of the century, which seemed to turn popular views on what climate change is and how important it is, to now little pockets, you know, popping up, people saying it's meat production, it's electric cars of the future, a lot of distraction. How do you deal with the frustration of trying to get your message across without people leading people down paths that won't actually be beneficial?
Look, I think because one of the upsides of being in this area for so long is that you play a long game. I've realised, you know, no one should be naive enough to think that any one thing that they write, any one speech they give, even any one movie or documentary that's made will be the thing that makes a difference. You know, you mentioned The Inconvenient Truth, and that's probably the closest to a major turning point of anything that anybody's ever done. It actually came out in 2006, the same year that the Stern Report on Climate Change Economics came out in the UK. And together those things did raise awareness of climate change to an absolute height in 2006 compared to the years before and after. But I think, you know, I've been in this game, if you like to call it that, for long enough to understand that no single thing that I or anybody else does is the turning point, usually. It's actually the collective of all of those things. And so I think of my work as every day as putting another tiny little brick in the wall, and lots of other people are putting little bricks in the wall as well, and collectively we will get there, I hope. So, yes, it can be frustrating, but if you allow frustration in this area to stop you doing something, you'd never get anywhere. You just have to brush it off.
Yeah. Tell us about that couple of years with, you know, you received that call from Will Steffen and he said, hey, look, this is what we're doing. We're creating the Climate Commission. Come and join our band of merry people. And what was that 2.5 years like? Talk us through what you did.
Yeah. Well, the Climate Commission was tasked with informing the Australian public about climate science, about the risks of climate change, and about the sort of economic solutions. There were six of us, the commissioners. So Tim Flannery was the chief commissioner. Will Steffen, my colleague, was one of the others, and there were three others from different walks of life. Most of us hadn't met before. I knew Will and Tim, but hadn't met the others. So we were sort of thrown together at the deep end. We met in Canberra at Parliament House, and the minister at the time, Greg Combe, was fantastically supportive. And he said, all right, you've got a secretariat supplied by the Department of Climate Change. What we want you to do is travel all over Australia and tell people about climate change. So for the next 2.5 years, and this was not a full-time job. I still had a full-time job running my department.
So, okay.
So that was a little bit challenging.
Just put your out of office on.
So we started by just flying to different regional centres. Our very first one was in Geelong. We decided to pick Geelong as our first port of call because at the time it was the most carbon intensive city in Australia, because there was an oil refinery, there was lots of big manufacturing. I think there was an aluminium smelter. Geelong was producing more carbon than any other city in Australia. So we thought, well, we'd go into the lion's den here and talk about carbon pricing. So our first meeting was in the Geelong Town Hall, and despite the fact that the Cats were actually playing that night, we had over 500 people in the hall and a long line of people waiting outside, including a whole bunch of really crazy protesters. We had federal police protecting us, some of them in plain clothes. We had 24-hour numbers on our phones in case we were threatened, that we could call at any time. It happened a couple of days after Tony Abbott had appeared as an opposition leader on the lawns in front of Parliament House with the Julia protest. So if ever there was a toxic time in climate change politics in Australia, it was actually that week that we started to do our talks. So at one point it was being, because it was such a novel idea, there were six of us sitting on stage and we were being filmed live on the ABC 24 and on Sky, so, you know, no pressure or anything. And at one point there was this huge noise at the side of the stage which sounded like a gunshot. Oh. And I actually thought, oh, my God, Tim has been shot. Oh, and really? I looked over. To my relief, Tim was still sitting there live and well. And what had happened was that it was so hot under these lights that the cameraman at the back of the stage had fainted and fallen off the back of the stage with his camera. And, oh, you know, it was this huge... But the fact that I thought that it was possible that Tim had got shot sort of gives you a bit of an idea about the tension in the room. So
how
we did that.
How did you How did you feel about that, Leslie? Because, like, you've waltzed out of the corridors of academia and into a maelstrom of emotion and public scrutiny. And I would imagine, as the six people sat on their plastic chairs on the stage to answer questions, the buck probably stopped with you because you probably knew the most.
Well, I guess we hoped we knew at least enough to answer most of the questions. And we were up on that stage for about 2 hours, so it was pretty exhausting. I just sort of kept surreptitiously looking at my watch thinking, oh, my God, you know, how are we going to get through this? But you know, afterwards, we went back to our hotel and ended up at the bar and we had a drink that we really needed, and then we had another drink, and then about the third drink, we had all decided that it had actually gone quite well and that we should do it again. And so we did. We kept doing it again and again and again, and in the end, we did about 30 of those events all around the country, most of the capital cities, lots of regional places, lots of places that had coal mines and, you know, we had people like George Christensen in the audience and that sort of thing. But, you know, the thing that looking back really strikes me is that by far the majority of people that came to those things were absolutely willing, genuinely interested in learning. They were, you know, mostly on side already but wanted genuinely to find out more. In the end, we really had very little pushback and heckling. It did happen sometimes, but you know, we came up with ways of dealing with that, and I think we all just toughened up over that period of time and felt that the positive things that we were doing were worth the occasional heckle. And one of my favourite things about all of those meetings was that after we finished the formal part of the evening, we would sort of go down into the audience and serve tea and coffee and biscuits and chat to people. And that was just enormously rewarding. You know, there were people from all over Australia, from all walks of life, who just wanted to ask questions and talk. And I just really enjoyed that.
Yeah. When you think about your purpose and what gets you out of bed in the morning, you know, that's a really different thing from what you'd been doing previously. Were you thinking, and are you thinking, I suppose, that the work that you do is you got to get out of bed in the morning and run your hardest because you got to save the planet?
Yeah, look, it's a huge motivator. And, you know, I've got two children who at the time were very young when I was doing the Climate Commission. They're now in their 20s. And they're, you know, all the motivation I need, really. You know, one of the slides I actually devised during the commission time, because Will Stefan and I'd give a little science presentation at the beginning. And, you know, when scientists put up graphs, 99% of the people in the audience, you can actually see their eyes glaze over, you know, a two-dimensional representation of a really big complex thing is really hard to get across. And so early on I thought there's got to be a way of presenting this data in a way that's more meaningful to people. So what I did was I devised this graph, which has subsequently become known as Leslie's grandkids slide, and I don't have grandkids yet, but I put up a sort of a slide of potential temperature increase and put my lifespan on it at the average temperature that I will experience in my life. And then I did the same thing for my kids and then sort of hypothetical grandchildren if my kids have kids when they're about 30. And basically my grandkids, if I have them, will likely live into next century. And on current trajectories, they will be experiencing basically an unlivable climate. And so I started putting this slide up. The first time I did it, when we went down into the audience to have the cup of tea afterwards, a woman came up to me. It was in Tamworth. And she said, I burst into tears when I saw that slide because I've got grandchildren and that's the first time climate change has become real to me. And that was a huge lesson. I mean, I've showed that slide to thousands of people now, but it was a huge lesson in how to communicate because unless you can make climate change real and make it about the things that people care about, which is their loved ones and their financial security, et cetera, then you're not going to reach the audiences that you need to reach. And we need to employ all sorts of different communication strategies. There's not one size fits all. But that's ended up what motivated me. And it's also a constant and interesting challenge to keep coming up with new ways of communicating that moves with the times and moves with the audience.
So you're doing all this amazing work. You're running around all over the country for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And then it's Tony Abbott's about to take the big gig, the big job. And so what did that mean for the Climate Commission and what did you do about it?
Well, we knew because we'd heard from the opposition that if they got in, which was looking increasingly likely, they would abolish the Climate Commission. So we were prepared for that eventuality. And so we all... Tim sat us down one day in a hotel room in Melbourne where we were about to go on stage and said, look, it looks like, you know, we're going to come to the end of this gig, but I don't think we've finished our job. Would you be willing, if we can raise some money from philanthropists, for example, would you be willing to keep going in some other organisation? And we all said, absolutely. So... we had Amanda McKenzie, who was our communications advisor at the time, wrote a business plan in her weekends off. We trademarked the name the Climate Council and we were all ready to go before the election. Abbott got in and abolishing the Climate Commission was the first act of the Abbott government. Even though we were expecting it, it was still a shock, you know. Mm. I thought, oh, they won't really do it, will they? Oh, yes, they've just done it. So luckily we did have the plan, you know, we had that backstop. And Tim, about a week later, went on Late Line ABC because they'd said that we'd prepared a media release about this new organisation called the Climate Council. They said, we want to break your embargo. Come on and tell people about it. So he went on Late Line, said... you know, we were going to set up a publicly funded organisation, a not-for-profit, to keep doing the message because the outcry about the abolition of the Climate Commission was enormous. You know, I think people were pissed off that the Abbott government got in and they were especially pissed off that their first act was to basically abolish an organisation that was totally devoted to communication of science. So Tim said, look, our website is going to be open for donations at 1 minute past midnight. And at about 1 minute past midnight, the first donation of $15 from James in New South Wales came in.
Good on you, James.
And from then on, it was the wildest ride. By that afternoon, we'd raised over $200,000, you know, and just mostly small donations from all over the place. At one point, we were getting $30,000 in every half hour, and it triggered an algorithm on PayPal, an anti-money laundering algorithm, and it shut the site down, and we had to get it back up again, which is a whole other story. But the whole thing was being run off a laptop by a couple of guys from GetUp in a Surry Hills share house in the early days. Yeah. And a week later, we'd raised $1.2 million, and we got together, somewhat shell-shocked, in the house of a supporter in Elizabeth Bay who basically donated his house to us to use as an office. And we used that for the next few years. He lived upstairs and we used the downstairs as an office. And we sort of thought, oh, my God, we've raised all this money, and we had this huge, we felt the weight of expectation of all the people that had given us the money, that we thought, well, we've got to start producing some content for these people so that they think that we're not wasting what they've given us. Yeah. So at the time, so that was the September going into October. It was going to be a very hot, dry summer. We knew that. We knew it would be a dangerous bushfire season. And so we thought, right, our first report's going to be on bushfires and climate change. So I started to write that. We didn't have any staff. I had a volunteer helping me. And then the Blue Mountains bushfires happened in October 2013, 200 houses lost. And the phones started to ring with journalists saying, what's the link between bushfires and climate change? And we got together with a whiteboard, drafted up some dot points, put out a media release, and it went crazy. Mm. The report then came out in November, and that was the first of about a dozen reports that we've written about bushfires and climate change. And we were away.
Amazing. Hey, when you think about Australia, we've got the highest greenhouse gas emissions per capita of any of the 36 OECD countries. Our emissions are almost twice as high as the average. I think from some of the stats that I've read, you know, we emit four times per person more than the average person that lives in Sweden. You think about our government's response and approach around addressing climate change. Can you make us feel better and talk to us about, you know, you've written about the six signs of hope. Like, is there a fast fire six that you can shoot at us to help us feel better about the plight of where we're heading?
Yeah. Look, I think people get understandably hung up on the hopelessness of the federal government and its policies, you know, because it's in the news all the time. And they're, you know, moving at a very glacial pace and the glaciers are melting towards doing the right thing. And they're being pushed now by basically the Biden administration and EU initiatives. So we've got to look beyond the federal government and look at all of the other things that are happening. So a lot of the Australian states and the local governments are doing fantastic things. That, you know, all of the states and territories do now have net zero targets. Places like the ACT going 100% renewable, getting to net zero very, very quickly. So that there is government action. It's just not federal government action.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, the community support for action is enormous, and we saw that with the support for the school kids strikes, for example. We are seeing business now absolutely stepping up, and even really conservative bodies like the Business Council of Australia are saying, no, we need a net zero target, and we need action, and we need investment in renewables, and we need policy certainty and all of those sorts of things. So, you know, it's sort of like there is this huge mismatch between the federal government and a few skeptics in its ranks, and they're mostly in the National Party, but not exclusively, and the sort of the collective of the rest of the country that is actually moving in the right direction. Of course, it could be just happening faster if we had some decent climate policies.
Yeah. Leslie, just talk to us about the numbers. What is it about Australia that why are we emitting so much more per capita than any of the other countries?
Well, there's a number of reasons. We have big distances, but mostly is we have a very cheap source of energy and have had it for a couple of hundred years, which is our coal reserves. We also have gas, but you know, Australia's wealth has not just been built on the sheep's back, it's been built on fossil fuels. So we have still a huge amount of our export income generated by fossil fuels. So those fossil fuel companies and their lobbyists, including, you know, groups like the Minerals Council, have been hugely influential, still are. And we've got to where we are as a wealthy democracy on the back of fossil fuel emissions, and that's just reality. So now we have a larger challenge than many other countries, not just to replace the electrons, which is the easy part. The hard bit is to replace the dollars when we're not getting those electrons from coal. So in a nutshell, that's why we're so behind. We have been so free and easy with our energy source, and we've earned a great deal of money, and we all live better lives because of that income. That's the harsh reality, but that means that we have, I think, an even greater responsibility globally to show leadership, and we have to do that.
So how hard is it for a young, aspiring politician coming through the ranks with all the best intentions and then suddenly faced with the fact that those fossil fuel industries are so influential in politics?
Yeah. Look, you know, being a politician is all about compromise, but I think that young politician these days would have an easier job of it than even a couple of years ago. I mean, a couple of years ago, Scott Morrison turned up with a lump of coal in Parliament. I don't think he'd do that today. No. You know, that would be totally politically unacceptable. Incidentally, by the way, that what I've heard is that lump of coal had been given to him by the Minerals Council and specially lacquered so that he didn't get coal dust on his fingers when he passed it around in Parliament. But anyway, that's an aside. Look, I think with things happening globally very quickly now, I think we cannot underestimate the wonderfulness of Joe Biden getting in for all sorts of reasons, but climate in particular. The EU's Green Deal now as well, movement by the UK, even by, you know, our major trading partners like Japan and China and Korea are all moving in the right direction. There is now really serious talk about carbon tariffs being imposed upon us, Australia and like countries. And, you know, finally, at the end of the day, it is all about money. You know, money does make the carbon world go around. And if Australia if our trade suddenly becomes subject to carbon tariffs, we'll see very, very rapid change because we won't have any alternatives. You know, the really sad thing is that given the renewable energy resources that we have in this country, why we couldn't have been out ahead of the pack rather than being dragged kicking and screaming to do the right thing, you know, that is decades of missed opportunity.
Yeah. Hey, just back to you on a personal level for a minute. So when you consider the extremes of emotional responses to the work that you do, from, you know, anything from blatant disregard of the facts to deniers to widespread ignorance and apathy. You know, you were saying the other day that some people in your field have received death threats, hate mail, you know, all these sorts of things. And then there's those that really understand the repercussions of inaction and that do champion change. As an explorer, as a person, as an individual, as a, you know, a wife and a mother, a super smart person, how do you continue to show up every day? How does Leslie look after Leslie's well-being to remain positive and keep fighting the good fight?
Look, I think the human brain is a very complex organ, you know, and you can hold almost mutually exclusive thoughts in it at the same time. So, you know, I think most of us who are in the climate change, whether we're in the climate change science space or the advocacy and activist space, actually hold pessimistic and optimistic thoughts simultaneously. There's no alternative, really. Sometimes I wake up and I'll see, you know, the latest awful paper about Antarctica melting at, you know, so many times the global average, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, and it'll be a rock in my stomach. And then you just got to put that aside and focus on what you can do, because I think I remember a few years ago there was a very effective anti-smoking campaign that relied on this idea that every cigarette you don't smoke is helping make you better. And I kind of have that attitude to climate change. You know, every molecule of carbon dioxide we prevent going into the atmosphere is making a less worse outcome than we might have otherwise had. Mm. So while we are absolutely faced with more pain, it might be unadaptable pain, I don't know. It will depend on what happens in the next 5 to 10 years. I think that's not a reason not to try. And I've come to the conclusion that while hope is obviously an emotion, it's also a strategy, and it's a fundamental strategy, because if we don't have hope, then we don't do anything. There are people that have given up. You know, they're called doomists, catastrophists.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't really think that that's a moral option either. I think the only moral option is to keep going, to keep trying, to try to understand each of us individually what we can do with our own talent and time and treasure, sort of thing.
Mm.
And keep trying. And I do want to, on my deathbed, be able to look at my kids in the face and say, look, I know it's bad. Hopefully it's not as bad as it might have been from our collective action. And at least I really tried. So I think that's all you can do as an individual.
You love a quote from Desmond Tutu. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I came across this quote a few years ago on a website, and I wrote it out. It struck me so powerfully that I wrote it out on a little post-it note, and it sits above my desktop computer on my desk at work. Hopefully I'll get it right. Desmond Tutu said, "Do the little bits of good where you are, because it's all those little bits of good combined that will overwhelm the world." And it really buoyed me up, because when you do get frustrated and demoralized that whatever you do as an individual isn't enough, I sort of use that as an antidote. And I say, well, look, I can only do this. I'm going to do this with the best of my ability, and I trust that all the other people doing things with the best of their ability will collectively overwhelm the world. And I look at that quote every day, and it is an inspiration.
Yeah. I was watching Netflix earlier on in the year, and I watched Attenborough's A Life on Our Planet. You know, it was super entertaining. All the stuff that he does is visually brilliant. And it positioned that we don't indeed need to just save the planet, because perhaps the planet will outlast us all.
Mm.
We indeed need to save ourselves.
Yep.
So if you think about Desmond Tutu and those little bits of good, what advice would you have for the average Australian? What are those little bits of good that we can do to help change the current trajectory?
Yep. Well, there's all the obvious things, I suppose. Reducing your meat intake and dairy intake is one thing that everybody can do, even if they don't become a vegan or a vegetarian. There are things like if you can afford it, you can get an electric car and solar panels and a battery and all of those sorts of things that everybody knows about. I think the most important thing, however, you can do is to use your vote and to make sure your local member knows that you are only going to vote for a member which has a good climate policy. You can also move your money. Most of us have money in a bank or yep. superannuation or insurance, and there's a great website called Market Forces that I'll give a plug to that give you information about what your bank's doing in your superannuation company, and you can, with a couple of clicks, do that. But I think I listened to a webinar just yesterday, actually, by Michael Mann, who is a fantastic climate scientist and has just written a book. Written lots of books, but he's just written a new book. And he also emphasises that what the fossil fuel lobbyists and companies want to do is to focus all our attention on individual action because it distracts from their own action or lack of it. Mm. So while all of our individual actions are really important to do, the voting and getting politically active and aware is also hugely important because it will be those sorts of higher level policy things that make the most difference in addition to the individual action. So don't fall for this line that it's all of our individual responsibility.
Yep.
Yes, at one level, we are the consumers and the users of electricity and of planes and all of that sort of thing. But we can have a healthy, wealthy life here in Australia with the right energy policies, the right climate policies, and the right mix of, political action. That is not impossible. So let's not or just be distracted into our own little households. You know, the Prime Minister, for example, is very good at just trying to distract attention by talking about plastics and recycling as if it is the answer to climate change. It's an important environmental issue, obviously, but it is a distraction from the main game. We also can be distracted sometimes by politicians talking about, oh, we're going to adapt and we've just got to learn how to be resilient and all of those sorts of things. Well, we've got to understand that a future world may be unadaptable too, and resilience only goes so far. So, you know, the other thing that Michael Mann said yesterday was drawing the distinction between what he called hard and soft denialists. So the hard denialists are the sort of Tony Abbotts of the world saying climate change is crap. That's easy to deal with, easy to ignore these days. The soft denialists are more the politicians like our current Prime Minister that says, oh, we'll get there with technology, we're not going to use a tax, we've got to look after jobs first. All of these are delaying tactics, and delaying is as bad as denying. Being aware of the language of politicians and the danger of soft denialism is also something that each of us voting individuals also need to do.
Hey, amazing advice, and thank you so much for that. You've been super generous with your time today. We just wanted to say thank you. You know, I remember as a kid going off to primary school and sitting down in front of the class and our teachers talking about explorers. And I always, my first picture of an explorer is someone that is brave, resilient, just doesn't stop until they reach the place that they want to go and find. And hey, that sort of sums up you and sums up how I picture, the work that you're doing on a day-to-day basis. So, hey, keep putting on that pith helmet and that khaki green jacket and wandering out into the desert or wherever hypothetically you're going, because you're doing amazing work. And we really appreciate the time you spent with us today. So thank you, Leslie.
So much.
All right. Great. Thank you very much, Leslie.
Well, thank you. That was really fun. I hope you got what you needed.
Yeah, we did. That was
Hang on, I'm just going to turn off my.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Done. All right.
Yeah, that was amazing. Thank you so much. Such a such an amazing life you've had.
Well, I think it's been, you know, I sort of feel guilty saying this, but I think I've had a more interesting life because of the climate change issue than I would have if it hadn't been there, you know, in a way. I mean, it's a sort of silver lining personally, I suppose. But, I mean, I do sometimes think, gosh, you know, if I'd done anything else in academia and not gotten into this area, I mean, I think I would have got there eventually, but maybe not had the opportunities that I've had by getting into it early, you know, my life would not have been nearly as interesting, I think.
Yeah. So I could have spent an extra 20 years studying ants.
Yeah, I don't think I would have done that. But, you know, and there's nothing wrong with the people that do that, because some people do. But I do get bored easily. So, yeah. You know, the one thing about being in the climate change business is that there's always something new. Yeah. We've just, for example, and I'm a complete non-sport person, but we've just written a report that's coming out shortly on climate change and sport. So I contributed to that, and I've been able to write about tourism and agriculture and all sorts of things. And my next report that I'm planning is about climate change and fashion, because, oh, wow. You know, the fashion industry is responsible globally for a huge proportion of emissions. And I think bringing that to people's attention and giving them some tools to reduce their fashion emissions is kind of an interesting and fun challenge. So I'll always be looking for things like that to do.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on this week's episode of The Dolanders, Leslie, and sharing your passion and your story with us and our listeners.
So, Blake, that was Leslie, and you might have noticed that Leslie didn't actually say goodbye, and it wasn't her, it was us. The recording actually cut out just at the last minute. But what did she say? She said, oh, thank you so much, guys. It was amazing to be on this incredibly high-rating podcast, and I look forward to listening to the actual release or something. Words to those effect.
Let's hope that that's actually what happened and she just didn't go, yeah, I'm sick of this conversation. I'm out of here.
She'd never do that.
No, she wouldn't. Yeah, what an amazing woman.
She really is. And pioneer in the space, in her space.
Incredibly humble. Like, she said that she's grateful for the journey that she's been on and been able to, you know, I think she's referred to as riding the wave, when in actual fact she's created that wave.
Yeah, she has.
Like, you think of the inertia behind climate change across Australia, and she's been at the absolute forefront of that.
Yeah.
What an amazing woman.
Sure is.
When did climate change come onto your radar?
It was definitely after watching An Inconvenient Truth, which I watched in the cinemas. I remember walking out of that with a few friends and looking at each other going, wow, this is not just a fringe event or a, you know, a minority group who are sort of just shouting about nothing. It's a real thing. Mm. Not sure why it took a movie screen, but it you know, that changed the opinions of a lot of people across the globe. And I guess the big challenge that we as individuals face is, what can you actually do? And I love the way that Leslie just said, it's just one brick at a time. It's the small choices you make. It's the leadership you give to your kids and people in your community. Nobody loves a pushy, you know, soapbox person. But it's those small little things, one thing at a time. If you can start doing that, it'll start getting around communities and things will start changing. And obviously your vote is very important.
Yeah, spot on. Like, I think about Leslie, and as she said, right, she could have sat in the world of academia for the rest of her life. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but she absolutely wanted to make an impact. And you're right that, you know, there are steps that we can take to make an impact on a day-to-day basis. I think the last thing that you can look at this and become really overwhelmed, and it is quite frightening. And I know that, you know, for the kids of today, many of them are frightened about the implications of climate change. But when Leslie spoke about the six things of hope, and she's written about this, and you can Google it and have a deeper read. But you know, she focuses on the amount of money that the universe is now spending on research and trying to combat climate change, tech, government, the laws that are passing, the power of people, and of course the next generation of kids that actually really want to make a change for their future and their kids' future.
Yep. And here's something for our listeners to all think about. Superannuation is a thing in many people's distant future, maybe some not quite so distant. But the investment choices that your super fund make, if you care about climate change and your investment choices are aligned to things that are not in the best interest of the long-term future of climate or, you know, broadly sustainability, you've got to think, why would you do that if you care so much about the climate? All those little things do add up.
Sure do. All right, mate, that's it for this week's episode. Geez, I'm excited for next week's episode.
Yeah, me too.
Who's on?
Well, just scroll up on your list, Blake, and you'll see the next one pop up.
I'll do that right now. See you, Matt.
Bye. The Doolanders does not promote financial services advice. Do